Welcome to the Brothers and Books podcast, where we get the best authors, their books, and the stories behind some of their best lessons to come on and speak about their incredible lives and the books that have changed them. I'm Dylan Conway, the host and the head book dude at the world's coolest book club, Brothers and Books. If you like this podcast or you want to see your favorite author on it, just rate the podcast and leave a comment. Without further ado, this is the world's coolest book club. Thanks for listening to the podcast, and I hope you have a great week.
This podcast is sponsored by GetSome.au. GetSome.au is the only certified supplier of Jocko Willink supplements in Australia. Check out their website and grab a Jocko Go Can, the healthy alternative to energy drinks, or load up on some Jocko Willink supplements. GetSome.au are proud sponsors of the Brothers and Books podcast, so support us by supporting them. GetSome.au, built to work, made for life.
Very excited today because I'm joined by Heather Morris. Heather, Hi. How are you?
Hey, I'm great being here with you today, Dylan.
Thank you so much for coming along. I've just gotten 30 pages into your upcoming book. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us a bit about the book that's coming out at the end of this month, I believe?
Yeah, look, it's only about 2 or 3 weeks' time. This book is different to the other three. I've moved not only out of the Holocaust, but I've moved out of the European theatre of war. I think it was time to come home, come closer to home, and tell the stories of Australians during World War II. Yeah. It's called Sisters Under the Rising Sun, a group of Australian nurses who were captured by the Japanese in 1942 and held prisoner in the jungles of Sumatra for 3.5 years. Or as my main character, Nesta, says, 3 years and 7 months. And it's a story of not only the Australian nurses, but these incredible English women, Dutch nuns and Dutch colonials, Singapore and Chinese women, 500 plus women and children who were captured and held in these horrific, horrific prisoner of war camps.
Heather, what was the motivation behind wanting to come and write some Australian stories? I know your background, obviously New Zealand and Australia's your home at the moment, but what made you want to write some of the Australian veteran stories as well?
I've got myself a Kiwi woman in there, trust me. And it's for real. The people I've written about are real. They are true people. Sadly, none of them are alive now, of course. But in terms of wanting to write that story, well, it's kind of weird, and I hope people won't take sort of this the wrong way, but I only started writing 5 years ago, so like, say close to 6 years ago. And some parts of the Australian industry have not considered me to be an Australian author because I don't write Australian stories. So there was a little element of it about, well, okay, maybe I should do the right thing and tell a local story, or part of it anyway. But my wonderful publisher in London, she knew, lives in London, but she's an Aussie, and she knew a little bit about the Australian nurse's story and asked me to have a look at it and see what I thought. Well, here's the crazy thing, Dylan. I was thinking about it, did a little bit of research, and a couple of my ex-colleagues down in Melbourne said, oh, come and have lunch, I haven't seen you for a while. I'm having lunch, and I thought, look, I'll float it past them. You know, they're chooks my age, and maybe they know more than I do. So I mentioned the story of the Australian nurses held captive by the Japanese. One of my friends kind of looks at me and goes, you know, one of those nurses was my cousin. I know her story. I know their story. Sealed the deal.
Wow, and this is a reoccurring theme.
Yeah.
I know you're a professional listener for these stories to come out and find you because Originally when you wrote The Tattooist of Auschwitz, you were a nurse, is that correct?
No, I worked in the social work department of a big hospital. No, I don't like the sight of blood, but...
And that's where you met Lale Sokolov.
Well, yeah, through a friend of a friend from there, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was this crazy coincidence of having this friend who I hadn't seen for a while and having a cup of coffee with her and literally her saying to me, oh, my friend, his mum's just died and his father wants to tell his story to someone. Do you want to hear it? Do you want to listen? Do you want to meet him? Well, what's his story? And she said, I don't know. I said, well, why don't you write it? And she said, because he wants someone who's not Jewish. So a week later, I knocked on the door of Lale Sokolov.
Now, writing this story, You go to a lunch and then my cousin has gone through this. So did you go through the process again where you went out? I know you do a fantastic amount of research for your books. What's the process been like for your most recent one?
Well, I was able to use her to give me photos and articles and the story that she knew of her cousin. It was a cousin, third cousin. She had two other cousins also who knew her, of course, who were living in Wales. So I was on a plane and to Cardiff to now spend time, and Deb came as, was there as well in Wales. So getting the story from this family and of course, research. But trying to find the research on these nurses wasn't easy because there's not a lot been said or written about them, with the exception of one. Yes, and this is a name every person in Australia should know. Sister Vivian Bullwinkle. My gosh, that we don't know and haven't been taught about her is a shame.
Even the Holocaust in World War II, whilst it's, you know, widely written about and documented, it isn't really, because of all of the different historical writing and everything that they got rid of once they knew that it was coming to an end. So what was it like studying all of that, as well as tying it into Lael's first-hand accounts when you met him?
Yeah, I'm really quite particular about this now. Of course, when I first started writing Lally's story, I didn't know what I was doing. And the research I was doing initially was actually shocking me. And it was because, you know what, that dear, beautiful old man was actually downplaying the horror of it. So I would then go home and find out something, and I'd have to go round to him and say, "Are you bugger? You know, you are not telling me how bad this was." And he'd just look at me and give me a hug and go, "I'm here. I'm still here." Because that was actually quite distressing to realise how much he had downplayed it. But I come back to the whole notion of research, and there's only so much you can do. Facts and figures that are proven, absolutely, you've got to get them right. You don't bugger around with the timeline of the Holocaust. Just don't do that. But on the other hand, I was telling Lally's story. I was telling it from his memory. And at that point, it didn't matter how other prisoners, survivors had survived, had perceived, had witnessed, had experienced. Because everyone is different.
Yeah. And we can only see through our own eyes and have our own perception of things as well. And for the millions of people that have now read his book and the impact that you've had on their lives, I'm surely historians are happy that the semantics of little things like that don't make a big difference when you're able to get those stories out and raise awareness about what these people went through.
Yeah, now some of the academic historians weren't overly impressed at the time. And I kind of got where they were coming from in the beginning. And to them it was a simple matter of, well, you don't reduce the Holocaust down to the story of one. It had to be about the entirety. But if you want to understand the story, you can actually relate to one person better than you can the number 6 million. So, yes, we now have got a nice sort of relationship where, well, many, many other stories have come out and will continue to come out about that. But, yeah, look, it was Lally's memory. It was his story. And I know I'm jumping forward here a little bit, but my third book, The Three Sisters, you know, two of those sisters were still alive when I met them. Only one is now. And the older one, Sibby, she had recorded videotapes for the Shoah Foundation in Israel. They're in Israel. And Sibby and Livy were the two that were in Auschwitz the longest before Magda joined them. Now, these two girls, I've got Livy telling me about it one-on-one in person. I'm watching a tape that she's done. And I've got Sibby's recording of it as well. And I'm going, "Hey, hang on a minute, Livy. You said this happened when this happened. You saw this." And Sibby's saying something different. And for a lot of the storyline, I was quite perplexed. Why or how could these two girls, standing side by side, witnessing the same event, remember it differently? So that was a bit of a dilemma. Who do I believe? And so lovely Livy sort of pointed out to me, "Well, you know, I was only 15. You know, Sibby was 19. And of course, our maturity, our education, our life experiences, it plays a part in absolutely every memory, even you and I have.
Definitely, definitely. And I know there's a lot of like psychology books written about the fact that people's memories are not as reliable as we believe them to be. But I think in your circumstance and the books that you've written are so important for people now, just because of the quantity and the impact that they've had all over the world. If that leads to more people doing their own research or picking up a book again, and we spoke just prior to the podcast starting off about how many more men are reading books because of from the publishing's data because of the Tattooist of Auschwitz, then I think that's a net good for society, remembering what people have gone through, at the very least, not to mention the perspective that Lolly's story has given to so many people around the world.
Yeah, look, I can actually tell a little story, and I'll be brief on it, how this relates to men and the impact it has had on some of them. I got an email, oh gosh, Lolly's book had been out about a year, and I got an email from the warden of a prison in South London. And he wrote to me saying that they had two copies of The Tattooist of Auschwitz in their library there, and half a dozen prisoners had read it. And these men had become really, really affected by it. They were going out and giving their version of Lolly's story to all these other prisoners, 1,500 men, maximum security, got to say, men in this prison. And all of a sudden, a catchphrase came up, a catch cry of, be like Lolly, when things were not going well. And for them, it was a matter of, he was this dude who had been in prison way worse than theirs. He had survived, and he got out and he had a good life. Well, within a few months, I found myself sitting in a room with 100 of those men for 2 hours. I suspect only half a dozen of them actually had read it. 700 men put their name down on a list to come and be with me that day. I have no idea how the 100 got chosen. I can only imagine, you know, good behaviour and all of that. But being with these men and who just wanted to now tell me about their family, their circumstances and how they were going to change was for me life-changing, utterly. And when I'd finished chatting with them, and I didn't talk, I moved from sitting in front of them to sit beside them in small groups, and we just then had this conversation. And my publishers had sent along 100 copies of the book. So we said to them, hey, listen, chaps, you know, you can have it. And so they go and they were picking up the book, and one of them came over to me and he went, you know, can you sign it? And I, yeah, sure. So I had to get a pen off a guard because I wasn't allowed to go in with anything. Yeah, gosh, it's worse than going through the airport. Anyway, I went to write in his book and I said, what's your name? And he said, oh, can you make it out to my mum? So I went, sure, what's her name? So I wrote to his mum and he said, and to say, I promise mum I'll never come back inside again. So I wrote those words. Now the man standing next to him said, can you write it in mine? Can you write it in mine? I was now writing books to wives, to girlfriends, to mothers, and writing the most incredible things that these men who were just breaking down in front of me, telling me what they wanted me to write. You know, one of them comes up and whispers, can you write it to my partner? Does it matter that he's a man? I'm going, no, honey, it doesn't. And one gentleman, he was this big sort of a Caribbean gentleman standing in front of me and he had tears streaming down his eyes. And he wanted me to dedicate it to his 3-year-old daughter who he'd never met. And he wrote that he would be the best daddy in the world when he got out. So I did that. And I looked up and I made my one mistake of the day because I'd been really coached on how to behave. Yeah, what to ask and what not to say. But I looked at this guy and I just went, do you want a hug? He was about 6'6", 6'7", and he went, ah! So I got up and I gave him a hug. And then the man behind him went, can I have one too? And the man said, can I have one too? So after about 20 hugs or so, one of the guards finally came up to me and went, listen, love, they haven't touched a lady in a long time. At which point I kind of went, okay, guys, hugs are off. but it was all really beautifully and innocent. They were just so emotionally overcome.
It's incredible. What did the guards think watching that? Because they would see these members on the spot listening to you speak and also reading your amazing book, wanting to change their lives. What an amazing impact.
Yeah. Well, they were standing behind me. There was about 6 of them and they were always very close behind me. I never felt threatened for a minute. Not at all. And at one point when one of these men were saying who they wanted the book dedicated to, I heard the sniffling and it was behind me. And I turned around and I saw 3 or 4 of these guards sniffling and wiping away their eyes and not looking anywhere and looking up at the roof. Yeah, absolutely. They were caught up in it.
Incredible. And I'm never going to get this opportunity again because I know you're extremely busy and I'm so...
Never too busy for you, John.
I'm so grateful that you come in today, but I need to tell you my own story just quickly and what your book meant to me. I was suffering from having multiple back surgeries and every day I'd have to go into hospital and see the nurses and the doctors and get my wound changed. I had a rather large open wound It's very distressing, very painful. And I've got my whole chest tattooed. It took about 12 hours. But to have this bandage changed probably once every 2 days, I'd prefer to get 12 hours of tattooing done. So it was incredibly painful. Mm-hmm. And so I was stuck in bed for about a year and a half on and off. And I read the Tattooist of Auschwitz, and I just said, like, wow, I'm connected to a wall. I can't really walk or go outside. I'm in and out of hospital all the time. And I was feeling quite down on myself. Mm-hmm. But I read your beautiful book, and it did. It provided that perspective to go, mm-hmm. hey, you know what? There might be all these things in the world right now that aren't going my way. But isn't it amazing that someone like this can find gratitude in a much worse circumstance than mine? So I'm so unsurprised about the prisoners in that jail finding that perspective from your book. And I have to ask you as well, and this is a little bit of a joke.
Okay.
And how does it feel knowing that not only are you responsible for over 20 million people reading your book and potentially changing their perspective in life, but also making about 20 million people cry with your words?
Look, what I hope is the crying that takes place is not because they're sad or they're overcome, or if they are overcome, they're just overcome with emotion. And I don't give a damn what the emotion is. Just let the emotion rule who you are. Good, bad, happy, sad. That's how you know you're living, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Feeling.
I have to admit I'm running a readathon at the moment, and I've read two of your books already again for my readathon just this last week. And both times, even though I've read them before, they did bring a tear to my eye again. And you're right about that emotion. No one's ever felt worse after a cry, have they?
Exactly. You know what part of Tattooist makes me cry still? Mm. And it's not anything connected with the horrors that were going on in the camps. And I hate it because every now and then somebody, if I'm being interviewed, say, oh, will you read part of the book, and they'll flip it open. And if I flip it open, it always opens on this one section, this one page. It's like it's designed to get to me. And it's the scene where Lully comes back to Krumpaki and finds his sister. Now, that means more to me than it can to any reader, because I sat with that man and watched him weeping as he told me what it meant to be standing outside his home. And I've been to Krumpaki many times. I'm actually have got a certificate. I'm an honorary Krumpaki and a citizen of this town in Slovakia. And I can just feel him and see him. One member of his family had survived. And so reading that for me is still tough, because it's not the words on the page. It becomes my memory of Lully telling me.
The part that got me was when he finally find guitar.
Oh, yeah.
After all those years. Now, for you, and you mentioned earlier that he was downplaying some of the story and you had to get it out of him. You've done so much research on the Holocaust. And speaking with Lully and getting the story firsthand, I thought it would be a good question to ask you today. And I know there's a lot of books out there, but with all your research and firsthand accounts from Lully as well, what a day in Auschwitz was like, and for these people that suffered tremendously.
Well, if you woke up in the morning, as Lully said, it was a good day, because you woke up and that was enough to start. And what then would happen and transpire from then on? 99.9% of the time there was nothing good about it, except for him, those moments is when he got to glimpse Geeta, of course. Or do something that he could do to help somebody else. The winters in Poland are cruel, just so cruel. And you know, many, many people die just sheer because of the environment and the elements. And then in summer, it's stinking hot and dirty and windy. When I first went there, it was one of those hot, steamy days, and the wind was blowing the dirt everywhere. And you can't imagine what it was really like to be there. No one can understand or accept the Holocaust, because to do that, I think I'd go crazy if I ever could really understand how it happened or why it happened. But a day was all about just, for him, putting one foot in front of the other. Now, he was a canny guy. He was, as he said, I never took a step anywhere from when I stepped outside my block in the morning without looking around me to see where the danger was. Now, that was how he got through each day. That was how Sibby, my 19-year-old sister got through the day. But 15-year-old Livy, she told me that her days, she was just a zombie. And she did just walked blindly from one place to the next, often just being steered by her sister. So, yeah, for everyone different.
And your book as well, you mentioned what the horrors that were happening in Birkenau and also what females had to deal with on top of obviously the hard labour with the male prison guards. Mm. Incredibly difficult story to tell, but super important as well to get out for these women that suffered these tragedies.
Dylan, they were raped. Mm. There was no other word for it. And when Silke's story came out and I got criticised because, well, Hitler put out an edict, didn't he, that no soldier was to have sex with a Jewish girl. Oh, come on. You know, my 15-year-old Livy, she told me a couple of lovely stories. One of them was about Silke. But the other one was how she worked in the Canada. We're going through the clothes. And to her, you know, all day, every day, guards just came in and you hid your head, you buried yourself, tried to be invisible because you didn't know who they were going to grab and then just literally rape them on top of the clothes in front of everybody else and get up and walk out. Just so to say it didn't happen is a huge insult.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, we did do some research. We tried to find out why the historians had decided that they wouldn't go down that path. And they think rightly, I think wrongly. Their rationale was, well, we didn't want to shame the women. Mm. It's not their shame, darling. It's our shame.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. Mm. And I think telling the story and, you know, because a lot of people would assume as well, but the amount of survivors that wouldn't have ever told anybody, both what they went through in the camps, yeah, but also that on top of it would have just been, would have been huge. And so Silke's journey just, it's so moving when you read. And I thought it was also super important that you talked about, well your second book, the Russian gulag system, because for me, I feel like history forgets. And for whatever reason, Hitler as a charismatic dictator draws a lot of attention from historians and schools and stuff like that, and the Holocaust. But Russia and the communist regime, and for me, reading Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, whether it's A Gulag Archipelago or One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, when I read those books, I was like, where are the stories and the documentaries
on this?
Why
aren't they now recycling?
This? Yeah.
They've got to recycle. Here's the weird thing. As I say, I go to Slovakia quite a lot, and people that I meet there and have met there, and the elderly ones who were around at the time, they sort of joke, you know, the Germans came in and took over our country, and then the Russians came in, kicked them out, and then we welcomed back the Germans. That's very telling when you hear that from 90-year-old women who were there and survived both those armies.
And see, I don't know how you feel about this, and you're very well researched. I almost feel as if obviously Russians were our allies, and then post-World War II, you know, there's a Cold War and stuff, but the reason we weren't talking about, well, maybe no one knew to a degree, but the gulags as well is because Winston Churchill, you know, was sending Russians back to Russia after they won the World War, and then they suffered these horrific, horrific prisons in the gulag.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Silke's Journey, all my books are published, by the way, in Ukraine, including this new one. My Ukrainian publishers, they are still publishing it. We do deals where they are given it, and it's very, very clear that there's no payments, no advances, no royalties. And I've done many talks into Ukraine, even during this current war that's going on there. And it is a war, folks. It is not some kind of police sort of, or just Putin sort of having a little pot shot across the thing. They are at war. And Silke's Journey was a huge seller, and I kept getting all these requests from television and radio and print media to do interviews, and I'm doing them. And finally I asked one of the journalists I was talking to, I went, you didn't have the same reaction to Tattooists. What is it about Silke's story? And he went, there's not a family in Ukraine that hasn't been touched by the gulags.
Which is just outstanding.
Yeah, and so for them, somebody's written a story about what we suffered through.
It's and that's, again, why your books had such an impact on me, obviously, going through a hardship and reading about this atrocity, God, it was moving, and the perspective it gave me was just incredible. The Gulag Archipelago and Alexander Solzhenitsyn's work to get that story out into the world almost feel like it's Russian's version of Anne Frank's diary.
Well, kind of is, isn't it? Yeah. I think maybe the thing with Solzhenitsyn right now is that he hasn't, maybe it's up to his publishers, whoever they are, how about you reissue it? That's the problem with all books from history, that if they don't recycle round with another telling, you know, slightly alter it or twist it a bit if you like, make it more relatable, more readable. If you want the gulags, just like the Holocaust, just like what happened to the women in the Japanese armies in Southeast Asia, then you've got to retell them. You've got to keep the momentum going.
And keep their memories alive as well. And Silke's Journey, and again, that's why I loved it so much, because a lot of people didn't even know that this existed, that these poor people spent years in a concentration camp only to be transported to another one. And Silke's story, obviously, especially sad for the reason that she was given, well, as Solzhenitsyn calls it, a tenor in the gulag.
Yeah, and listen, folks, the reason she was sent there, this 16-year-old girl who the commandant of Birkenau took a shine to and chose to make his sex slave for 3.5 years, she got sent there because the Russians charged her with collaborating with the enemy, for sleeping with the enemy. How dare she do that? She should have chosen death. Nah, not our Silke.
Brilliant. It's such an amazing book. And Three Sisters, you were contacted because the tattooist of Auschwitz is literally tattooing everyone as they come in, Lale. So many people would have had some even minor interaction with him, and so there'd be a lot of survivors that would have read your book, I assume, and be like, I got my tattoo from Lale as well. And these people from Israel contacted you and said, because I remember, I think I watched something, and one of the sisters said, I know these people. And so do you want to tell us about what that was like?
Oh, that was crazy. I got this email. I read it, actually. I was in South Africa on a little tour there. I was staying in the wine region of South Africa, just out of Cape Town. Okay, it's a very nice wine region.
I've nailed my present today, haven't
I? Yes, you have. And I came back to my hotel room about 1 or 2 in the morning. And, yeah, I've overindulged. Okay, I admit it. But throughout the day, my daughter back here in Melbourne had been sending me messages saying, hey, Mum, there's an email you've got to read, because she was keeping tabs on my stuff while I'm away. And I'd been ignoring her. Yeah, Mum, you've got to read this email. Mum, I'm going to ring you up. And I went, oh, God, I can't go to bed, even no matter how tired I am or under the weather. I'll read the email. And, yes, it was an email from a man, Odid. And, he picked up a copy of the book in Canada, flown to Israel to visit his mom. Left it on her coffee table, and it has the Australian cover. You know, only Australia and Brazil have the same cover as Australia.
And that's the black
cover? It's black with the two arms and the number tattooed on it. Yeah. So his mom, walking past, she was must have been 84 then. She's turning 88 in November. Livy looked down at this cover, and she said, that must be about Lale and Geeta. And when he said, how could you possibly know that? And she said, look at the number on Geeta's arm. Now look at mine. Hers is 3 away. Her sister Sibby's was 2 away from Geeta. They were lined up with Geeta. They went to school with Geeta. They're on the train going to Auschwitz with Geeta. Geeta had been and stayed with him in Israel after she'd come to live in Australia. So, you don't sleep after that.
Wow. And I remember, I think I was watching, he was telling the story about how he, you know, do I buy the book? Do I not buy the book?
Yeah.
And he was worried his partner's like, oh, not another Holocaust book.
Yeah, look, he's a darling, darling man. And as the firstborn of both of his parents were Holocaust survivors, and having grown up with that and in Israel, where everybody really as a child was a child of a Holocaust survivor, where it was little spoken about, he always just knew that there was a sadness in his mum that he just couldn't pinpoint. And this poor man had spent all his life trying to make his mum smile and trying to make her happy, giving her little gifts, saving his pocket money when he was a boy. And he admits, obsessed by needing to read about the Holocaust, and his mother and his sister, who lives in Israel, Dora just kept saying, don't talk, don't read, don't talk about it, don't talk. And that shut it off, but Odie couldn't. And because of that, Sibby, Magda and Livy now have this story told.
That's beautiful. That's so beautiful.
I got from where I was in Franschhoek went to Johannesburg, and then 2 days later just flew straight to Israel. I wasn't even going to come home. Yeah. I needed to meet these women.
Yeah. Wow. And so listening to their stories, and now I had the opportunity to meet Eddie Jacku years ago, and he was speaking to maybe 100 of us, and just fantastic.
What a man.
Oh, he's great, isn't he? Yeah, he's great. He probably was the happiest man on earth, wasn't he? Which is another interesting thing to see survivors from the Holocaust, from the Gulag, and just how their perspective is on life afterwards. These big, beautiful families celebrating all the time. Yeah. Listening to their stories firsthand, how has it impacted you in your life and how you see the world?
I see the world hopefully through their eyes even more. And for me, with all the bad that is going on, there are so many really beautiful things being done by individuals more than governments. And so I guess I'm more of a fan of trying to get out there that one person can make a difference. And folks, you don't need to rely on your elected members of parliaments and your corporate boards to change the world. You know, individuals just like you, Dylan, can make a difference. And you make a difference in the tiniest way, it all adds up. You're one piece of a puzzle, but my God, it's a lovely big puzzle when they all get put together. Individual people change the world, not governments.
Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful.
I was going to say something along the line, they beep it up. But
Well, that probably answers my next question. With the experiences and the stories that you've heard, how do you view world conflicts that are going on in the world today? And you mentioned your Ukrainian publisher, but surely, I'm assuming here, a pacifist, needless, these wars?
Oh, utterly. Yeah. You know, my poor boys, when they were growing up, I mentioned to you before we came on here that my late husband had been a Vietnam vet, but conscripted, you know, he had gone in that time. And I know that you'll come from the military, but I was such a staunch. I was one of those people marching in the street, you know, get out of Vietnam day. So I'm going back a bit, guys. I think I said to my two boys when they were becoming teenagers, you even think about wanting to go and fight. And then, I'll put a bullet through your foot. And I know that sounds terrible. And for me, I am now the biggest fan and advocate of those who serve. I go to the US and everywhere I see, because you see more people there in uniform, and I never, ever walk past one of them without saying thank you for your service. I see soldiers here, and at the airport, wherever I am, same thing. Because I've done a 180 on what I feel about the people who are in the military. I guess I blame them for perpetuating the violence, but it's not them. It's those buggers that sit in Canberra, that sit in Washington, that sit in Moscow. And for me now, it's just there is no group of people. Now, there's two groups of people in the world for me who are on the highest of pedestal. One are nurses everywhere, and the other are the men and women of the military in every country.
And that's a good perspective to have, because often when you see the fighting and the soldiers on the front line, they're believing in something bigger than themselves, that they're doing the right thing for their country, which potentially they are, but it's not their overall choice to go to war in the first place. They're simply doing the work.
Yeah, no, they're carrying out their duty. And how many of us do carry out our duty? Very few of us who are not part of an organisation like the military. My daughter, funny enough, she when she got to be in her early 20s, and she looked back at her dad and what he had gone through, and knows that, you know, her grandfather was in World War II. My great-grandfather was in the Boer War. He went to the Boer War with the New Zealand Army as a young teenager, naughty boy. And she went and joined Victoria Police. And she said, for this generation, I will wear the uniform. And so, yeah, there's this element of you owe something if you can to your community, if you're talking about a police officer in Australia, or the wider global community.
Yeah. And that comes back to your sentiments before about just impacting one person's life through that service, and whether it's a volunteering, charity, or through your workplace, just making someone's day. And that's what I now currently use your book for. So I've let you do all the hard work and I just buy the book.
I couldn't
agree more. And it's been great to have so many police officers picking up more books like yours as well through the charity.
Oh, VicPol were huge supporters of my books.
Yeah, amazing.
And I made many of them available to them, and in their my weekly or monthly magazine, they were doing full photo shoots of me with my daughter, my son-in-law, because she married a police officer as well. So the VicPol sort of were really embracing of the stories and,
What has reading meant for you in your life? Because like I've mentioned a few times, just how big of an impact your story has made on so many people. And you mentioned the prisoners before and maybe them stealing a few hugs off you, but the book as well, obviously, changing their perspective, giving them hope and a brighter future. Just that perspective that I think we all need. How has reading impacted you in your life?
You know, I grew up in a rural New Zealand small town, and it wasn't even a town actually. It was pretty much a nothing. The nearest sort of village, if you call that, had a pub and a general store. The only books I really had were the Encyclopedia Britannica. My mum and dad, they weren't big into reading, but they wanted us to have knowledge that they obviously just spared the education system in New Zealand would give us. They weren't wrong. And so for me, I was reading in my bedroom under the covers with a torch, stories of other cultures, other countries. They seem so far away from where I was growing up. And I was just captured by that there was this whole world out there that I knew nothing about. You know, I never knew a Jewish person growing up. And the place where I went and the school I went to, we had one girl who was of Chinese descent. It was what we call Pakeha, which is the Maori word for white or Caucasian, and of course Maori. And that was it. I didn't know culture, so I just absorbed Encyclopedia Britannica, read everything I could from all these other cultures. I was quite sort of taken by them. So not a lot of fiction, really. Yeah.
But it definitely opens the eyes up to the world. It reminds me, someone else, Elon Musk, he says that as a young man, that's all he could get his hands on
Well. Yeah, I did not know. I want to be associated with Elon Musk?
maybe not, but he was reading a lot of encyclopedias and going up in Africa or whatever. And definitely, you know, if you can get your hands on any books as a young person, that's why we're trying to encourage as much reading as possible, because it does. It really shapes your view of the world. Now, I know, Heather, you've listened to so many stories from Lale, the sisters, and written them as well. What are some of the stories that stand out in your head as some of the most saddest or unbelievable atrocities that these people had to suffer through?
For me, it's one thing that they suffered these atrocities and this hellish, hellish life. For me, the obscene thing is that they are not always believed. And those who want to talk about it are encouraged not to. Those who don't want to talk about it can be bullied into trying to talk about it. And I've spoken to many second and third generation survivors who come to me and say, they read the books and they go, my mum was there, my grandmother was there, they know their story and they won't talk about it. What can I do to get them to tell me their story? And for them it's quite simple. For me, I just say, well, you can't. They'll tell you if they want to, but you can't make them. Because I've been asked in many interviews, you know, do you think Lully told you the whole story? And I went, hell no, of course not. That'd be silly. He's entitled to keep anything private and secret that he wants to. He also told me one or two things that he said to me what I never ever mention. But maybe find a stranger like Lally did. And I've heard from many, many people around the world who have said that to, who did subsequently. I said, get in touch with a publisher, see if they've got a ghostwriter somewhere nearby, see if they can find a mix for your family member. And that has now happened many, many times. People, I'm a mom. I couldn't sit and tell my children and look in their face of those kind of horrors. Ain't going to happen. But in terms of, you can't ever, ever understand what they went through. If you get the chance to speak to a survivor, not just a Holocaust survivor, think about the immigrants and the refugees that we've brought into our country. Think about their stories. They are, 90% of them will be equally as traumatic. They may not have that same sort of Holocaust extermination, whole race thing, you know, to go. But their trauma is just the same as Lullies and Geetas and Silkas and anyone's. Yeah. If they want to talk to you, shut up and listen.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And if you, and especially with the migrants piece, you see it in Australian society. Firstly, I live right near a park. And what I always notice is that the people down there playing with their community, and it might be soccer, it might be volleyball, whatever it is, they're not Australian. They've come from another country and they've got that beautiful sense of community.
And family.
And family. Yeah. It's so good to see. And statistically as well, it's why there's so many amazing businesses that are ran by people with funny last names to us Australians because they come over here and they know how grateful they are to live in a country that, that is a wonderful country, probably the best country in the world, unbiasedly, of course. And New Zealand's great too.
Yeah.
but they don't take it for granted. They live their days to the fullest because they know what it can be like. And I think
they've seen the alternative.
There's so many similarities, like you said, to any sort of hardship. It definitely gives you that perspective to make the most of life and get out of your own head and start to listen to others and take life or live life to the fullest.
Yeah, you know, if I hear somebody with an accent and they're clearly English is not their first language and but they're getting there, they're speaking it, if anything, I feel embarrassed because I don't speak any other languages. Hey, that person, this might be struggling. But guess what? Now, they're smarter than I am. They've got a native tongue and they've learned English, the hardest goddamn language there is to learn. So for me, it's a sense of, a failure on my part that I don't. And I never have gone to the trouble.
Was this something that you always did, ask people about their story? Because listening to you today, it seems to be, it's led you to so many amazing places, just being interested in others. Is that something that you always had in you?
Yeah, but I was ignored as a kid. Growing up with four brothers, my family, my parents and a household of four noisy brothers, the interaction wasn't there because it was, as I say, farm life and it was very busy. But I had this incredible great-grandfather who lived a couple of paddocks away from me and he took me under his wing when I was a young girl and he was the one who taught me how to listen. Sounds weird, isn't it? But from a young age, he would sit me down every afternoon after school. I'd go and sit with Gramps. And he would just sit there and he'd go, after a while, so what can you hear? And I'd go, nothing, Gramps. He said, open your ears. There's sound all around you. And then I'd go, oh, okay, I heard a bird. No, keep listening. No, nothing else. Can you hear that tractor down in the background? And I went, oh, yeah, but, you know, it's a tractor. He said, it's a sound. Isn't that dog? Which one is it? Do you know who that is? Oh, such and such. Sounds like he's yapping at the cows. Yeah, your dad's going to give him a kick up the bum, isn't he, when he gets home? And I would then try and create stories from the sounds that my grandfather made me hear. My brother, who lives in San Diego, I was in San Diego with them doing a talk, and he came along to listen to me at this big event at the Jewish community there. And somebody asked me that question, have you always sort of wanted to tell stories? And I went, not really. Look, I wrote my first book at 65, so clearly not. And my brother put his hand up and he said, she was always known as the family bullshit artist. She's been telling stories since she could talk. And I had forgotten that my family, my aunts and uncles are the family bullshit artists. There she goes again. She's weaving another yarn.
And were they stories that you were creating from the sounds you were listening to?
Yeah, yeah. If I tried to tell them that a couple of cows spoke to me on the way home, why shouldn't they believe me?
Yeah,
I had a conversation with them.
What a great lesson from your grandfather.
Oh, he was a darling.
It flips it on its head, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, here's a skill to learn. Just listen. Just simply listen.
Yeah, look, I think it was about maybe 8 to 10, somewhere in that range when we first started. And I remember the dear sweet thing saying to me, because it kind of really stuck with me, and he did say what I think everyone, when you get older, say to the next generations down, you know, you'll learn much more than I'll ever know or ever can know. And I'm saying there's only one thing I want to teach you. I want to teach you how to listen.
It reminds me of Dan Millman's book when the mentor's telling him, or Socrates is called in the book, and he's saying, stop, what's going on right now? Nothing's going on. It's like there's never nothing not going on.
Yeah.
And he just takes in everything. I think that's a brilliant lesson to learn from your grandfather. And there's probably some parents out there listening today. It's like, what a good skill to sort of inculcate.
But you don't realise it as a kid. And that sort of just got indoctrinated into me as a way of life.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, decades later that I suppose when I started working in a hospital, and then all of a sudden it was all about shutting up and listening. If you're going to be able to make the slightest little difference to somebody who, once again, every day for 21 years, the only people I met were there because something tragic or traumatic had happened to them.
They all have a story.
Same thing. The only way you can help them is to shut up and let them do the talking.
Yeah. And it's crazy, isn't it, that everybody has something like this going on in their lives to a degree, to differing levels. But so many people feel so alone. For yourself and someone that's written stories of people who've gone through incredible hardships, seeing things like mental health crisis in Australia and New Zealand, obviously no doubt as well, what do you think is something that can assist these people try and find gratitude and meaning in their lives?
You know, look, if you've got somebody in your life, and whether it's a relative or a friend, and there's something going on in their life and you don't know what it is, and you say, well, they're not going to tell me, how do I ask them? Well, you've got to pick your time to start with. One of the things that I try and tell folks is, say, who want to, how can I do this? If you know them well enough and you know there's already a level of trust with them, look around in their home or in their environment. See if there's a picture on the wall, a photo on the wall, on a sideboard, or there's a knick-knack there, and you just know that it's been there forever. At the right time, just go to that photo and say, hey, can you tell me who the people are in this photo? Can you remember where it was taken? Or do you remember when you bought this? Who was with you? Because that's there for a reason, because it means something to them. Funnily enough, we do tend to throw out things in our life that don't mean anything, and we hang on to the silly little things, the things with no commercial value but with all the value in the world to the person who's hung on to it. And that is an in, being able to get them and then just listen. And once again, if you shut up, keep that silence there for a while, I'll keep talking.
I think that is one of the smartest bits of advice that I've heard, because I know Are You Okay Day and things like that are used to be like, hey, you know, check on your friends. Focusing on something with sentimental value, and then I love that last part, if you sit there in silence for long enough, they'll keep talking. Yeah, so just listen, hey? That's
it's not really rocket science, is it?
It isn't rocket science, but the way you just explained that, it just seems to make a lot of sense, and it's not something that I hear in the common narrative either. And there's a good quote, I forget the man that said it, it was Tony Robbins' mentor above him, and he said, if you want to be interesting, be interested in someone else. And I think a lot of us would do really well for just maybe just one day, or just aim for a goal for one day. Hey, listen to what every person I get to meet today has to say. Maybe I'll learn some incredible stories. And
yeah,
I know how you come across Lale through stories to meet that person, but the story that you've got to now tell all over the world and share his story, and a beautiful memorial for Gitta as well. I know he would have been just so proud and so happy.
Oh, he'd be skipping around there, yeah, dancing with his doggies.
He would be super happy. All because of but your grandfather's lesson to you to listen to people, and then you knowing that that's an important thing to do, to be able to tell that story.
And don't rush it. I mean, gosh, I know it's been rushed on that I spent 3 years getting this story out of Lally. That's not quite right. Many months, maybe up to 12. And even then, but, you know, our friendship just lasted those 3 years up until the day he died. But even then, sort of a few days beforehand, because I was with him, it was his 90th birthday, and we were having our normal sort of coffee and cake, and he still would say to me, did I tell you about? And I go, what now? And he'd say something to me and I go, oh, no, you bugger, you haven't. And again, something would come out. But it's a matter of always just making the person who you think you want to hear something from, that they're comfortable with you. And you mentioned Are You Okay Day. Now, that's a great initiative. I grant you that. But there's no point in saying those words to somebody as you're just walking past them and you're in a crowded room where, of course, they're going to say, oh, yeah. Or if they do say, yeah, I've had better days, they're not going to follow it up. You need to have the right environment.
It's interesting because I feel like that initiative, and again, I can't speak to what they're achieving. I'm sure they're doing a great job. But it's funny because it's focused on the individual that asks the question. Mm. So you feel like, I need to say, are you okay? I need to say, are you okay? And you forget to do the most important part sometimes, which is listen to what the person's telling you back.
And do you actually, and are you ready to hear what they might say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can think of a few times in my life where I've heard someone in physical distress, you know, when they're verbally telling me I'm not okay, and then knowing what to do after it. It's a difficult situation to put yourself in, that you should if you can. And it sort of segues into my next question. So I asked, what are some of the most difficult things that these people went through? And you mentioned not being believed, which again, the culture after the war towards the Jewish people as well, it sort of had that lingering, oh, maybe the Germans are right and these people are, you know, lesser than, which is just horrible and really cemented in, maybe no one wants to hear my story and, you know, I deserved it almost, which is horrible.
Well, there's the guilt of surviving.
Yeah.
Survivor guilt is a very, very real thing, and it's also graded.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, some people who cannot get on with their lives because their survivor guilt is just so, so strong. But, you know, to come back and find your entire family's gone and they're all dead and you're not, it kind of begs the question, why did I survive and they didn't? And so survivor guilt then plays a huge part in how they can then go and live their lives. Yeah. You know, for people like Lully and Geeta, they made that the promise, part of their wedding vow was that we will live the best life we can, because to do anything less would be to dishonour those who didn't get the chance.
It's such a large scale as well. Something like the Holocaust. Like, I've heard of survivor's guilt in maybe a car accident or a bus tragedy or something like that. But it's such a large scale. You know, even if you didn't know, if you came to, and it would be very rare, maybe not. But to go to the death camps as an individual, not know anybody, but still see this much death around you. Mm. Yeah, incredible.
And how utterly, utterly senseless it all was.
That's right.
Oh, because of your religion, of which you had nothing you could do about.
Even the gulag. Now, I've read that the efficiency or the economic gains from the Soviet Union's gulag system was lesser than what it produced, because they were starving people, mm-hmm. collecting the coal, etc., trying to fund the Soviet Union. And they actually lost money through the enslaving of millions of people in these systems. It's so devastating, just the loss of life.
You know, I was told a story, and I believe it, because the person who told me, it was his brother it happened to. I met this man in Czechoslovakia. And he was out and out, gentlemen. His brother had been a lawyer and a judge in Russia, in Moscow. And he was asked, because he spoke English, to be Stalin's translator at the talks with Churchill and Roosevelt. So he was there in the room and was doing the translating for both Stalin and then into English for the other two. And then he was going back with Stalin into the groups with the rest of the communist leaders that they were, and hearing what was being said by them. Oh, yeah, we've got them. Yeah, we've got Churchill on the run. And hearing they really were saying one thing but intending to do another thing. And we know that that other thing happened, which was to create the Soviet Union and shut it down. And just because he was Stalin's translator, he got sent to the gulag. For no other reason, because he had to get him out.
So ridiculous. Mm. 10 years, well, Silke, right? Mm. Hey, got raped in Auschwitz, therefore 10 years in the gulag system. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, as you know, where he was an artillery officer fighting for the Russians, and he just said, oh boy, you know, it's not looking good up here on the front. Like, I hope the generals know what they're doing. 15 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was just having a conversation about 1984 and George Orwell, and obviously he's so close to Winston Churchill at the time. And people talk about 1984, and these days they go, oh, you know, it's becoming more of a reality. And perhaps that's true. But the Gulag and communist Russia at the time, minus the technology, but even then, the way that that book is describing how people are telling on each other, using kids and the propaganda to, you know, point out the spies, that was going on during the Gulag. It is just... I feel like that book was almost nonfiction for Russia at the time period, and surely George Orwell, I know he'd seen different things in Burma and in the wars and as his time as a an officer and a policeman, but surely there was some truth in that book about trying to get the story about what Russia was doing to its people at the time.
I despaired. I said to my publishers, there's no way a Russian publisher who'd taken tattooers, they won't take Silke's story, you know, because I don't really have anything nice to say about them. But they did.
They did.
They did, and it sold really well. And there are independent schools. I think there might be sort of more that sort of English school in Russia right now for which tattooist is on the school curriculum. Go figure.
Interesting. But not Silke's?
Not Silke, no, but tattooist. They wouldn't do that.
One leads to the other, doesn't it? Yeah. That's interesting. And so my question was going to be, what was one of the stories that – one of the most profound stories of bravery, of courage, or even as kindness that really touched you listening to the stories of the survivors?
It's one of the stories which is mentioned a little bit in Three Sisters, and it's about a young girl, early 20s, called Marla. And Marla, she was in Auschwitz with the girls, and she had a semi-privileged position because she spoke multiple languages, so she was being used as an interpreter by the Germans, pretty much like Lully did. And that's also, we're just on the sidebar, crazy thing that, you know, Lully, the sisters, they speak 3, 4, 5 languages. Okay, those Slavic languages are kind of interchangeable in some words, but they did. And she fell in love with a young Jewish boy in the camp also, and they escaped. But they got caught, and when she got brought back, you know, they were going to be, if she was to be hung, her and the boyfriend, they got caught, brought back at the same time. And he was in the men's side of the camp. They were going to hang them at the same time. Now, the girls, Silke, Peter, Livy, who told me her first-hand account of this, Sibby's account of it, of Marla being brought in to this compound where every one of the women in the compound were brought out. She's going to be made example of. And she stood there defiant, naked. They were stripped naked. And one of the SS women at the head of the camp, she was just going around pointing out to all the girls, you know, yeah, you think you can escape, we'll hunt you to the end of the world and you'll meet the same fate as Marla will. And Marla apparently, and Livy was standing very close to her, and she said she just stood there and she just had a smile on her face. And she just looked and she said, you can't do anything to me. You can't, that the love I have for this boy, you can't take that away from me. Killing me will not take that away. And stood there defiantly. So I've only written a little bit about it because they've actually had symphonies written about Marla in Poland. But somebody had smuggled her, giving away a story plot here, had smuggled her a razor blade, and she had it hidden in her hair. And Livy said that she was just watching Marla the whole time, transfixed by her. And at the appropriate time, Marla just got this razor blade out of her hair and just very quickly sliced both her wrists. The story of what happened to her, and once again we did the research and there's lots of things there that say we don't know what happened to Marla. I know what happened to Marla because Livy, the 16-year-old girl, was told to go and get a wheelbarrow. And as she bled out on the ground, Livy ran back with the wheelbarrow and the person, the prisoner, a guard said to another girl, to the two of them, load her in it. And this 16-year-old girl and another girl, not much older, then wheeled this dying young girl who just was in this wheelbarrow. She bled out to the gas chamber. But Libby said they went really, really slowly. Now, this is a 16-year-old girl making a decision that she did not want that girl to die in the oven. So they went slow. And they were pretty sure when they did hand her over, she was dead. How does a 16-year-old girl come to that kind of comprehension? I don't want her to burn alive, because that's what she was being sent to do. Go slow. Yeah, phenomenal, isn't it?
And there's so many stories like that in your wonderful novels that do, that bring a tear to your eye just listening to them. And I need to ask the other side of the story. Now, books like Ordinary Men, and we all have a choice in what we believe in. The people committing these atrocities, and there were a few, obviously, that, you know, even in Ordinary Men, these reservist military police officers, of all people, that said, no, in the early days, I'm not doing this, and they left. So we all have a choice. What do you think that these people were corrupted by, or do you think it's group psychology? I'm interested. What led people to commit these atrocities?
Well, one thing we found out about the guards, the SS guards in Auschwitz-Birkenau, is that they were drugged every night with LSD. Mm. So they couldn't think for themselves even if they wanted to. And that also sort of kept them awake and kept them supposedly alert. And it's one of the things I remember Lully say to me, because we talked about going back, did everyone want to go to Germany and go back to Auschwitz, and how he felt about Germans. And he sort of said, well, you know, I feel about them how I feel about anybody. He says, just the one thing I cannot understand is how could that silly little man hypnotise an entire country? Because that's what Hitler had done. He had hypnotised the German people, who then just perpetrated. And it became just a snowball effect. Just not him, though. There are those other leaders of the Himmler, etc. That, you know, you got a lot to answer for. But for the running, the SS officer, the ones who went to Auschwitz, well, that was considered to be a good gig. And so they really wanted to go there, because you were safer there than you were on the front line. And so, yes, for them, they were going to do nothing there to jeopardise where they were, because it was safe. Crazy. But the whole notion of them being drugged again.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the lead SS character in my book, Beretsky, funny little story. I was in Slovakia earlier this year because they were just about to start filming the miniseries. And the night before the first day of shoot, the actor who's playing Beretsky, he'd been in touch with me and we'd had a Zoom chat. He's this beautiful German actor, Jonas. And then he knew I was arriving in Slovakia a couple of days before the first shoot. And my two sons were there, and he got in touch with me. He just said, look, can I just meet you? I need to talk to you some more. So I said, well, come to my hotel, come and have a drink, meet you in the bar. My two boys are here with me. You know, they're adult men. And I said, come and we'll have a chat. And he sat down and he goes, I don't know how to play this guy. He goes, there is nothing about him that I can get a handle on. There's nothing that I can feel that is acceptable for his behaviour. Tell me how to play him. Did he have any redeeming feature whatsoever? And so my two boys and him, the more we drank, the more they were throwing the crazy ideas at how Jonas should play Beretsky. It got quite lovely. But then I remembered a story that Lully told me about him, about how guilty he felt at having run away from his home. He was Romanian. As a 13 or 14-year-old boy, he had a very abusive father. And he not only beat up on him, Beretsky, or Stefan, that was his name, but his mom and his sisters. And then one day his father beat him up. He was apparently 13 or 14. And Beretsky picked up a lump of wood and hit his own father around the head with it and then ran away and never came back. And he told Lully about the guilt he felt at having to leave his sisters to take the punishments that he now had run away from. It's somewhere deep down that guy had... He could feel the guilt at having done something as a young boy, and that he was now what? So he was at 13, 14 then, he's now 24, so only 10 years later, he's still struggling to live with it. So I'll wait to see what Jonas did with his portrayal.
Yeah, so I'm – so and I'm noting the time. The Stan series of The Tattooist of Auschwitz is coming out – is it this year? Is that correct?
Oh, it'll be early next year. Amazing. It's all about the timing of filming it, and that timing is not governed by Australia but by the US and the UK.
Perfect, perfect. Mm. And your newest book, I think I might have mentioned it earlier, but it's coming out at the end of this month. Is that correct?
Yeah, the end of September.
Awesome. Well, so we're still running our big readathon. So I would assume that some people might be changing. There's 5 books that you need to read in 50 days, which sounds like an easy feat for someone like yourself, I'm sure, with the amount of research you've done. But it's just to get more people reading books again. Yeah. I reckon we'll see a few people swap out their 5th book that they were going to read for your new book,
Just briefly about it. As I said, it's about these Australian nurses and this one particular English woman who represents many of them. Now, that particular English woman, she was an incredibly gifted musician. She had trained at the Royal Academy of Music in London. There's a plaque there with her name on it. And for her, what she brought to the survival of those women for those 3 years and 7 months was the gift of music. She could write down music scores from having just, she knew them, and that's what she did. And I have seen and I have held in my hand music scores written 80 years ago in the jungle of Sumatra. Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, Ravel, handwritten by her on scraps of paper. Now, that's music. Already there, they had some choirs going on in the camp. But what Nora wanted to do was to create music. And she formed with some 40 to 50 women a vocal orchestra. And she taught them to sing Mozart, Beethoven, Ravel through the sound of the instruments. We have music therapy as a given now in every part of health professions, from traumatic hospitals to mental health. For me, I don't know if there's any other first recorded use of music as a therapy for these women and what it did to them, hearing this music of these women performing. Even those Japanese soldiers were reduced to tears because of Nora and what she did. She's my Nora, and of course I never got to meet her, but you know who I did meet? Her daughter. Because Nora, 2 or 3 days before she got on that fateful boat, along with Nesta and the Australian nurses, Nora, whose husband was in hospital, he was really, really sick, she put her 8-year-old daughter on a boat with her aunt and 2 little cousins and sailed them out of Singapore, never knowing if she would survive. And that young girl, Sally, now she I have met on the island of Jersey where she lives, and her son and her Sean there. And I'll be back on Jersey in about 3 weeks' time giving a talk there on the island for all the island people who all know Nora. But music, folks, my book is about the love of music and what that can bring to your life. Oh, just phenomenal. And
3.5, how long were they prisoners in the jungle?
3 years, 7 months.
That's right, 3 years, 7 months.
Yeah. And to have these documents, because she managed to save them, and we've got some of them reprinted in the book. I think if you've seen a book, they're not there yet, but they are now in the book, because her daughter, Sally, and Sean have given us permission to reprint these, and we're hoping to get a choir in London perform. Wow. One of the parts of one of these, her adaptation of it.
Wow. Well, I've got goosebumps for 2 reasons. Just because, you know, this story I've definitely never heard about. Mm. And hearing about a choir in a prison camp.
And a jungle.
And people coming together to get them through like that. It's brilliant. Well, 3 reasons. The second reason is that I'm just excited because this book, I know what your writing's like, and I've had the pleasure to read your other books, so I'm just excited to get to relive that experience. And like we spoke about, that emotion. Well, it does, and I think a lot of people, I know people listening today will have that same excitement.
Or Jacquiem, as they say in Slovakia, Jacquiem.
And it's about Closer to home, like you said as well. So I think I know there's a lot of nurses that follow the page, Australian nurses who serve in the military, who will be really looking forward to this. And hopefully this opens up another, not can of worms, but opens up more stories in the future about what these people went through, no doubt, when people in Israel, maybe not in Israel this time, are reading your books and saying, I know that person. I've got a story for you. So I look forward to watching some emails come through again because of this
thank
book.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll learn about the – and here I'm going to push the Australian nurse's story. And as I've mentioned at the beginning, there is one of these nurses. Her story is – because it's only a part of mine because Vivian's story in its own needs to be known, needs to be read. And Vivian Bullwinkle, by the way, only about a month ago became the first woman – who had a statue erected for her at the War Memorial in Canberra, long, long overdue. Now, once again, Vivian represents all those nurses. And her story of survival is, it's the same as Nesta's, but she's got one tiny little extra bit to her story, which is in mine. But that the women were denied to telling the truth by the government of the day. And I've kind of opened that a can of worms a little bit because while they were told, you know, Nesta and Vivian both went to Tokyo after the war and gave evidence against Japanese prisoners of war or some of the captains for the atrocities that they committed on them. They had the bravery to do that. All the way through, these women, they were told that they had to deny any sexual assault took place.
From the Australian government. While we were occupying Japan.
It's time for you to learn the truth.
Yeah. Well, mate.
But what you're going to learn is, once again, a story of courage beyond words of just four particular nurses who are not named, will not name, be named, cannot be named, because every single nurse that was there took their names to their graves.
Heather Morris, thank you so much.
Ah, Dylan.
Thank you so much for coming on today. And, God, I look forward to reading your newest book, mate. And like I said, and everything that comes with it. And thank you for all the work that you have done uncovering these stories and spreading them around the world and also providing perspective to people like myself who I was feeling pretty down on myself, much like those prisoners. Mm. And was able to find gratitude in a really rough situation because of your amazing storytelling ability and
the stories, Dylan,
in your books.
I still really just consider myself the lucky bugger that knocked on Lolly's door that day. You know, when you talk to every single Holocaust survivor or any particular horrific sort of event like that, every single one of them uses the word, "I survived because I was lucky." And yeah, luck does play a part in things. I totally accept that. And in the Holocaust, your luck was, did you get flicked to the left or to the right? Mm. Life and death came down to that, the flick of a wrist. So, and I'm the lucky person who got to meet him and then all these other stories that have followed. So,
well, like I said, I really hope more stories come from this, and I hope you do too.
They will. I've got a bit left in me yet.
Well, I hope that wine I give you allows you to have a break in the lead up to the big book release, the stand series as well coming out.
It's going to be phenomenal, folks. I've been on set and I've seen some of it being filmed. I went back and saw some more in May. And oh my gosh!
I feel like we're overdue. It's another conversation. I'm cognizant of the time, but we're overdue for another really great, important, informational movie, TV series. On the Holocaust. And you talked about recycling. Let's do
it. Keep it coming.
Very exciting. Very bloody exciting. All right. Well, thank you again for all your support to the charity, mate, and for jumping on the podcast today. And thank you to all the listeners at home.
Thank you.
Cheers, Heather.
Okay.